Deshpande, the late father of Maharaja Yudhisthira and his brothers.
The late father of Maharaja Yudhisthira and brothers.
Putran,
the sons of.
Upasinan,
sitting silently nearby.
Prashaya,
being overtaken.
Prema,
in feelings of love.
Sangatan,
having gathered.
Avyachashta,
congratulated.
Anuraga,
feeling.
Feelingly.
Ashayai,
by tears of ecstasy. Anibhutena,
overwhelmed.
Chakshusha,
with his eyes.
So translation, the sons of Maharaja Pandu were sitting silently nearby, overtaken with affection for their dying grandfather. Seeing this, Bhishma Deva congratulated them with feeling. There were tears of ecstasy in his eyes, for he was overwhelmed by love and affection. So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. When Maharaja Pandu died, his sons were all small children, and naturally they were brought up under the affection of elderly members of the royal family, specifically by Bhishma Deva. Later on, when the Pandavas were grown up, they were cheated by cunning Duryodhana and company. And Bhishma Deva, although he knew that the Pandavas were innocent and were unnecessarily put into trouble, could not take the side of the Pandavas for political reasons. At the last stage of his life, when Bhishma Deva saw his most exalted grandsons, headed by Maharaj Yudhisthira, sitting very gently at his side, the great warrior grandfather could not check his loving tears, which were automatically flowing from his eyes. He remembered the great tribulation suffered by his most pious grandsons. Certainly, he was the most satisfied man because of Yudhisthira's being enthroned in place of Duryodhana, and thus he began to congratulate them. So, Anaputran upasinan prashya prema sangatan avyachashtanu ragashrar andhibhutenu chakshusha. So, Om Gana Tivananda Shah Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshun and Miditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So implicit within this particular purport is a very important moral principle. Now, by the word implicit, I mean it's not directly stated, it's hinted at. There's two words in English, explicit and implicit. Explicit means you directly say something. Like explicit, let's say if you have a child, like there's some children here, if you say, you're a rascal, that means they're rascal. That's explicit. But you may be saying it affectionately, so that may be an affectionate term. Like we say, Krishna is a rascal, right? Isn't it? Krishna's a rascal. So we're not saying that. It's not the explicit meaning is not really what we're getting to. It's the implicit meaning. That Krishna's cute. So it's an indirect meaning. That's what implicit means. So there's an implicit discussion going on here in the Mahabharata and also the Bhagavatam about morality. And morality is a very interesting issue. You know, what is moral, what is immoral? But in this particular case, is something moral because of the act itself or because of the result of the act? Which is really interesting. And you'll see these two, what we call diametrically means two, opposed positions presented in the Vedic literature. And not only the Mahabharata, Bhagavatam, and other places. Like, is the act itself religious or moral, or is the result of the act? And you'll see this even going on today in different organizations, even Gaudiya organizations or Brahminical organizations. People are not aware of this particular discussion or this particular philosophical point. Although they're somewhere or other, unconsciously they're aware of it, but not consciously they're aware of it. So let me explain what I mean. Okay, let's go and tell a little bit of the history of Grandfather Bhishma. Grandfather Bhishma, way, way in the past, before he became Grandfather Bhishma, he was one of the Vasus. His name was Jal. And he did something that was not particularly religious or moral. He helped his brothers kidnap the desire cow, Nandini, of Vishishtamuni. Vishishtamuni has this beautiful cow that can produce milk, or gold, or ghee, or ice cream, or pizza, or anything you want, right? That's a desire cow. Anything, even soldiers sometimes come from his desire cow when he was fighting Visvamitra, right? So, the reason they wanted the cow was because her milk could enable someone who lived on the earth, some lady, to live a longer life and remain beautiful without plastic surgery. You know, nowadays they have the, you know, plastic surgery? Where they tighten up your skin if you have too many wrinkles. I've been worried about this lately, too, as you get older. So, without plastic surgery, you know, just stay young. You keep drinking this milk from the desire cow. So, they wanted to obtain it for some earthling. So, Bhishma was previously Jal, one of the Vasus, and it was his wife who really was pushing the whole thing. You know, she was pushing, you gotta get it, you gotta get it. And he was being nagged, basically, by his wife. And so they stole the cow. And after they stole the cow, Vishishtha knew about it, and he cursed them, basically, to take birth on the earth planet. And they all begged for forgiveness, and he said, I'll forgive you, you only have a very short life. However, this Jao, he will have a very long life. He will take the lifespan of all of you, live for a very, very long time, and you know, suffer quite a bit on the earth planet. So this way, Grandfather Bhishma was cursed to go or take birth. He wasn't Grandfather Bhishma at that time, he was Jao. And he was cursed to take birth on the earth planet. Okay. And then, at the same time, his father, who was later Shantanu, was cursed to take birth on the earth because he happened to look at Ganga Devi improperly in the heavenly planets. You know, he kept staring when the wind was blowing her dress. So he was also cursed. So I'm not going to tell the whole story of the Mahabharata. But in any case, he came down to the earth, and he was a great fighter, great soldier, and a great son of his father, Shantanu. Very, very devoted to his son, to his father. In fact, so devoted, as we know, the story goes, when his father later on became attached to another lady, first he became attached to Ganga Devi and just told her he would never argue with her, which every woman would like to have their husband make that particular arrangement, isn't it? Never argue with your wife. Wow. Prenuptial agreement. So, but later on, he became attached, this Shantanu became attached to Satyavati, who was extremely beautiful. And as we know, the story goes that Satyavati's father, not her real father, but stepfather, was a fisherman. I think his name was also Matsyaraj or something like the king of the fishermen or king of the fish or something, or kingfish. So he had imposed, her father had imposed a stricture on Shantanu that you cannot marry this girl, even though you're madly in love with her, unless her son becomes the king, and he should have no competitor. So Shantanu, as all men experience when they're in love, actually says that when one's in love, it's the same effect on the physiological body as when one takes cocaine. Did you know that? The scientists have done some brain scans, you know, some CAT scans or whatever, and they see it's the same areas of the brain that are lit up. So it's the same thing. So I'm not going to say which one is more dangerous. So, but one loses his intelligence. I think in Italy you have some song like that, like when the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. You've heard that, Silver?
No.
Could be. Yeah. I think there's an Italian song that I learned when I was young. So anyway, he sort of like got bewildered, went into a severe clinical depression. I mean, he was just sitting in bed all day long and moaning because he was so much attached to this Satyavati, the Shantanu. And his son, Bhishma, came and said, "What's wrong?" His father wouldn't tell him. But what happened is one of his father's assistants told Bhishma that your father's madly in love and therefore, he can't marry you because he doesn't want to tell you that you can't become the king or the heir apparent, that means the next king. So Bhishma, as a dutiful son, he went to this fisherman and he said, "My dear fisherman, I'll vow not to become the king." And the fisherman said, "That's all right, but you may get married later on. And your son may challenge my daughter's son." So Bhishma said, "I'll vow never to get married. Akanda brahmachari, unbroken brahmachari." And the demigod showered flowers from the sky and everybody was going haribo, nitaiguranga, whatever they did in those days. And so he had taken these vows, very strong in his vows. Very, very strong in his vows. So later on, the reason I'm telling this, I'm showing the principle of vows, how that contrasts sometimes to the principle of what's ultimately good. Or making a promise may not always lead to the ultimate good. And so sometimes the promise may have to be broken for a higher principle. Okay. So what happened is that Grandfather Bhishma later on got his brother, Bitra Treveria, married, and there was another one. What was his name? Anyway, Chitrangada. Chitrangada and Bitra Treveria, Chitrangada died because he was fighting a Gandharva by the same name. And Bitra Treveria, he arranged a marriage with with these three beautiful girls who he kidnapped, Amba, Ambalika, Anambika. I think in Sanskrit that means Amba, little Amba, little Amba, or something like that, right? You don't know Sanskrit very well. Anyway.
Not well.
So I think that's what it means. Amba, Ambika, Ambalika. That means Amba, the beautiful one, and then little Amba and very little Amba. Imagine calling your children that. Isn't it like Matura, little Maturini, and very little Maturini? All right. That would be something. So anyway, so he kidnapped the girls and he brought them to his brother. And his brother got so infatuated. It seems to go in the family, the people get infatuated with their wife or something like that. So he got so infatuated, he died prematurely. And then Satyavati said, we got to do something. There's no heir. There's no person to take over the kingdom later on. And you vowed not to be the king. So he had this vow he had made. He had to say, "I'm going to stick to my vow no matter what." And then she said, "Well, at least you should get married to one of these girls." Except one of the girls. Because in those days, it was a different yuga. It was the Dwarpa Yuga. And it was allowed for a brother, if his brother could not have children by his wife, the brother could actually have children like that. So this was allowed. Nowadays, of course, it's one of the prohibited things in Kali Yuga. Ashwamedha, Gaumedha, and then having children with your brother's wife, also taking sannyas, is prohibited, except for preaching Krishna consciousness. That's another interesting principle. It'll prove the same point. So Bhishma refused. He said, "No, I've taken a vow. Cannot do it. I'm sticking to my vow." So, all right. So then what happened is that she ultimately called Vyasadeva, who was her son, that she gave birth to before the marriage from Parashrava Muni. And Vyasadeva came and he enabled the two ladies to have Pandu and Dhritarashtra. And then, of course, Vidura came from the son of a maidservant after that point. So, Grandfather Bhishma, he had also taken a vow to support whoever was the king. So he's very strong in his vows. And that's not a bad thing. Actually, Prabhupada would sometimes comment on us Westerners. When we couldn't keep our vows, he was just very shocked. He said, "You can't even keep your promises. Something's wrong with you. You're not even human beings." You know, because in the Western world, as we have this saying, what is it? Promises are made to be broken. And nowadays, when someone gets married, of course, here in Scandinavia, nobody gets married anymore. But they just stay together for several generations. So, but in the, when people get married, they have this prenuptial agreement. You know what that is? That means, at least in America, it works like that. It says, now we're getting married, but when we get divorced, you will get the cow or the dog. No cows nowadays. And I will get the house. So they make a promise, but with the idea they're going to break it later on. Or when we were young, we used to do this thing. We'd cross our fingers. Do you have that here too?
Yeah.
And you say something that doesn't count. And we put our fingers crossed behind our back so that people couldn't see that we were crossing the fingers. Should people do that? Yeah. Same thing. So promises are actually very important. In other words, vows. We take vows at the time of initiation. And so Grandfather Bhishma was very strong with his vows. So he refused to help Satyavati at that particular point. Then later on, he had to support Dhritarashtra, and he had to support Duryodhana. And he couldn't even say anything when there was the attempted disrobing of Draupadi. Can you imagine that? They had Draupadi, she was lost in the gambling match. And the Kurus, Dushasan, of course, was attempting to pull her clothes off. And we know that Krishna became unlimited clothes, unlimited cloth, so that protected her. But still, he couldn't say anything. He was so strong in his vow. I've made a promise. Like that. And then in the battle of Kurukshetra, he had to fight on the wrong side. Even at one point, he took a vow that he had 5 arrows that were going to kill the 5 Pandavas. And Krishna arranged, of course, they stole the arrows, or they asked for the arrows, and they got them. And, you know, throughout his whole life, just promises were so important to him. Now, as I said, that's not a bad idea, to keep your promises, right? However, that's one aspect of morality, as we were discussing in the beginning of the class. Is morality to stick to the principles or to be concerned with the result of the activity? You know, if the result is bad, let's just make it more clear. Let's say if you stick to your vows and the result is bad, is that moral? Or if you break your vows and the result is good, is that moral? That's a really important question in morality. And religion, too. Like, we have all these rituals. Like, if you perform all the rituals and you don't remember Krishna, is that good? And if you don't perform all the rituals and you remember Krishna, is that good? What a question you're going to ask. Isn't it? Of course, we have a statement in the Bhagavatam. Notpadiyadyadi ratim shrama evi kevalam, isn't it? That even dharma swanishita pumsam vishvakshena katasiyat notpadiyadyadi ratim shrama evi kevalam. That even if you do everything perfectly in devotional service, I'm paraphrasing the verse, but you don't develop a taste for Krishna consciousness, it's a waste of time. That's interesting. Because we see many devotees are just like really into all the details. And you can really go crazy with all the details, especially if you read the Hari Bhakti Vilas. You know, you're not supposed to eat carrots, which would, frankly, is the only thing you can grow here in Sweden. Right? Carrots and potatoes.
And cabbage.
So that's one third, you know, one third of your diet is thrown out the window, you know. What are you going to do about, what is that called? Sauerkraut. And, you know, no sauerkraut, you know. So you read all these different injunctions, And basically, if you get into all the details, because that's called Nimagraha, you get into all the details, then you actually lose your Krishna consciousness. At least in Kali Yuga, because we're not capable of that. Like we hear in the Upadeshamrita, isn't it? Niyamagraha. Achahara prayasas cha pajalpa niyamagraha janasanga sulohim cha. So it is a very interesting discussion, you know, about the results. Of course, that at the same time, that doesn't justify doing anything in the name of Krishna consciousness. You know, let's distribute marijuana with books, you know, just to get people to take the books. You know, that doesn't, you know, that. But there is that statement, Vedic statement, what is it? You judge something by the results of the fruit, palena pata chiyate. There is that statement. So getting back to this whole story of the Mahabharata, Krishna sets exactly the opposite example. What does Krishna do? If he promises so many things and he keeps breaking his promises in order to either protect his devotee or to establish religious principles, which is ultimately to establish religious principles. Krishna promised that I won't fight in the battlefield. I'm just going to drive the chariot and behave myself. Krishna promised, right? Because there was that whole arrangement where Krishna was sleeping and Duryodhana and Arjuna came, and Krishna said, whoever I see first will have the choice between me and my army. But if you get me, I don't fight. If you get my army, I'll fight. You know, so there was this big army, it's called the Narayanas, who would be fighting in the battle of Kurukshetra. So what happened is that Krishna woke up, and Arjuna happened to be at Krishna's feet, you know, taking a humble position. And Duryodhana was at Krishna's head. So Krishna naturally looked at his feet first. And he said to Arjuna, you know, you get the choice. And Arjuna said, I'd rather have you. And Duryodhana was thinking, what an idiot he is. You know, Krishna's not going to fight. You know, practically he was saying, Haribol, you know, jumping in ecstasy. And so then he went back and told Shakuni the whole thing. Shakuni said, you made a mistake. That's in the Mahabharata. So Krishna had promised, I'm not going to fight. And so what happened is that they arrived at the battlefield, and actually two times Krishna broke his promise. More than two times Krishna broke his promise in very tricky ways. One time Arjuna was fighting just like a wimp, as we say in English, I would just say that in a word you can understand. Anyway, he was fighting in a very weak way because he didn't want to attack Grandfather Bhishma. And Krishna said, you know, if you're not going to kill him, I'm going to kill him. So at that point, Krishna got down. Two times it happened, actually, according to the Mahabharata. Krishna got down and he pulled out his Sudarshan Chakra and said, I'm going to kill this guy. And Arjuna had to grab him. And Krishna was basically dragging Arjuna across the battlefield, because Arjuna was trying to stop Krishna from doing that. And then finally, Arjuna said, all right, I'll fight seriously, I promise. But Krishna was ready to break his promise. Another time, Grandfather Bhishma took a vow to make Krishna break his promise. And then he was fighting so ferociously that Krishna grabbed the chariot of the wheel. That's the other story. And then other times Krishna played so many tricks, like making the sun disappear when Arjuna was fighting Jayadrath, taking the vow to kill Jayadrath by the end of the day. And Krishna was so tricky, like going in when Duryodhana, the final day, when Duryodhana was going to become invulnerable because his mother was going to look at his whole body, Gandhari was going to look at his body and make his whole body like steel. Krishna told Duryodhana, as Duryodhana was walking around naked, he said, at least you should wear a gumsha in front of your mother. I mean, how are you going to walk in front of your mother without any, you know, completely, private parts of it? It's disgusting. And so he tricked in that way. So you see, Krishna himself considers what's moral to be the result of the activity rather than the activity himself. So in other words, he was willing to lie. It encouraged Yudhisthira to lie, right? He said, Yudhisthira, you say that Ashwatthama is dead. Ashwatthama was the son of Drona. so we can defeat Drona. And Yudhisthira said, oh, I cannot tell a lie. And Krishna just said, what are we going to do? And then he said to Bhimsen, kill that elephant named Ashwatthama so Yudhisthira can say that Ashwatthama is dead. So Yudhisthira did the worst of both things. He told he told a lie while thinking he wasn't telling a lie, and he disobeyed Krishna. So he got the reaction of having his chariot touch the ground from that particular point and having to see hell, you know, when he left this world. So you see, like, Yudhisthira was another one who was very attached to just, like, the externals of Dharma. So it's interesting, this whole discussion that, you know, you juxtapose Grandfather Bhishma's understanding of Dharma with Krishna's understanding of Dharma. Very, very interesting. So let's fast forward to the modern age, where you have so many injunctions in the Vedic literatures, like a sannyasi should not cross an ocean, or a devotee should not see the face of a non-devotee. If he sees the face of a non-devotee, he should run to the Ganges immediately and take a bath without even taking the clothes off, you know, basically. So you have all these different, like, injunctions there. And we see that Srila Bhakti Sananda Saraswati Thakur and Prabhupada really understood the purpose of everything. When you understand the purpose of everything, then you can adjust or even neglect some of the injunctions to achieve a higher spiritual purpose. And of course, Krishna does say, you know, Sarvadharmam Purichaja Mamikam Shadanam Braja. I mean, just like Antam Sarvapapavyo Mokshi Yashami Masucha. That's Krishna's statement in the Gita. Because Arjuna was quoting injunctions in the beginning of the Gita. You know, you're not supposed to, you know, if you kill all the male members of the family, they'll be irreligion. You know, how could you kill? You know, certainly there are injunctions against killing your grandfather, right? And killing your guru. I'm sure there's injunctions about killing your guru. Isn't it? I'm sure there's Shastric statements. I mean, I don't know them offhand. But it's pretty obvious that you don't go around killing gurus. It's called Guru Droha or something like that. So, and I'm sure the Manu Samhita contains a lot of punishments for those who hurt or kill their gurus or even disobey their gurus. So, Manu Samhita has many heavy injunctions too. I'm not going to mention, I've heard some of them the other day, really shocking. So, basically, Arjuna, he had to kill his guru, Drona. I mean, he wasn't the direct one who killed the guru, that's his Dhrishtadyumna, but he had to fight with his guru with the intention of killing his guru. So you see that it's really the result of the acting, and Prabhupada understood this very well, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur understood it very well. Utility is the principle. I mean, that was what Prabhupada said. It's the result, and then you can adjust certain injunctions. And Prabhupada himself said in the books that he said certain injunctions that are applicable in India may not be applicable in the Western world, and the expert acharya has to be able to adjust things according to time, place, and circumstance. So that's really the point. In other words, whatever is favorable to Krishna consciousness, we accept. Whatever is unfavorable, we reject. However, let me give a caveat at that point. Adjustments, major adjustments, are made to be made by the acharyas, not by us. You know, we cannot adjust, let's say that we think it's more favorable to have three regulated principles here in Sweden, or even two, or at least you're a vegetarian. We can't adjust those things. But acharyas, they can adjust things, understanding the spirit and the intention of the Vedic literatures, and they're not violating Dharma. Because ultimately, Dharma means to do something that creates the right result, the dharmic result. Isn't it? That's actually what Dharma is. And Grandfather Bhishma did not understand that until the end, after everything was over. Because basically, I mean, because I understand it's a pastime, but basically he could have fought on the Pandava side. He could have said, yes, I made a promise, but there's a higher principle. there's a higher principle. And there are higher principles. There are higher and lower principles. I mean, even if, let's say you make a promise not to lie. Okay. I will never lie, never tell a lie. Okay. So then, this story is there in the Vedic literatures too. So, let's say there's a bunch of people running away. Let's say you're in some country and there's the government. Let's say you're in Libya. Okay. Let's say you're in Libya and you're protecting some people who are revolting against the government. The government soldiers come to your house and they say, "Are these people in your house?" And you say, "I cannot tell a lie, they're here." Then you're responsible for their being killed, even though you adhered to your particular vow or promise. So you have to see what is the result of something. And in Krishna consciousness, it's like that too. And also, insofar as preaching Krishna consciousness, we have to be ready. We can't just be attached to the way we did things like 20, 30 years ago and say, you know, that's the way we always did it. It doesn't matter. Where was I? Oh, yeah, I was just in Copenhagen. And there was one preaching center there in Denmark where the people are preaching to, young people come to the temple, they're preaching to them, "Your mother is Maya, your father is Maya." You know, and they put in their forum, you know, the Denmark Danish forum, that this person is so happy. This person wrote a note. He said, "I have determined never to see my mother again because she's in my." You know, so, huh? I mean, that's really taking things out of context, doing things the way the Hare Krishnas did like 500 years ago or something like that. So we sort of like, we become very ritualistic. We stick to certain things, or even we take external things as more important than internal things, like the dress style is more important than loving Krishna or being attached to Krishna's holy names. Things that are cultural and relative, rather than we take them as more important than the essential aspects of Krishna consciousness. It's interesting. So one has to be extremely introspective to understand the goal of Krishna consciousness and adjust things accordingly with great caution. So anyway, so that's some of the points I'd like to make. So any questions or comments? Yeah.
May I make a comment?
Yeah, sure. You can always make a comment.
Because, like you said, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he was very revolutionary and controversial. And one time he invited some British from the high ranking British important people, VIPs, to Mayapur, and he served the meat.
He arranged for us.
And then the devotees were shocked, "How can you?" And he said, "But otherwise they wouldn't come." So in order to make them come to Mayapur and preach to them, he was ready to...
To do that, I remember that. And then...
So that proves that point.
Yeah, that proves that point. You know, just understanding the principle, the goal, you know, the actual goal of religious principles rather than, you know, the intermediate principles. And also Prabhupada wanted a smoking room in the Bombay temple. You know, because, you know, people just can't stop smoking for some reason. I can't understand it. And I was just in an airport. I'm always in airports. And then, which airport was it? Oh, Frankfurt Airport. They have this camel room. Doesn't mean they have camels, you know, like in the desert. It's a type of cigarette, you know. So they have this camel room, and the people just like go in there. I mean, it's just like, huh? Even I walk by it, and I get nauseous, you know. Just like, it's not completely sealed off. That's the problem, you know. It makes you sick just to walk by it. So Prabhupada wanted to have something like that in the Bombay temple, like a camel room. You can call it a camel room, but, you know, a room for smoking. And so, obviously smoking intoxication is against one of our regulative principles. So, but Prabhupada said, you know, somehow or other, bring them to Krishna. And Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur also said the same thing. When his disciples came back from Europe, they said, you know, people are too addicted to meat and all these other things. He said, then give them meat. You know, the disciples were shocked. You know, and Prabhupada did so many things that were against Vedic injunction, in terms of he lived with someone who kept meat in his refrigerator. He lived with crazy people. You know, you just have to associate with us. His god brothers actually criticized them. They said, Bhaktivedanta Swami likes that. It wasn't that Prabhupada liked it. He understood the principle behind something, the reason behind something, the strategy. And so basically, we should understand the reason why we're doing something to become, to remember Krishna. And therefore, we can accept things like technology or whatever to help us remember Krishna. Like, you know, we all use these MP3 players, and I'm using this, it's broadcasting the class, and there's several people watching right now on TV. You know, but it's not Maya. It's technology. You know, a sannyasi is not supposed to wear sewn clothing. A sannyasi in the Gaudiya tradition is not even supposed to have a shirt. It's not supposed to wear saffron even. Did you know that? Traditionally, the Gaudiya sannyasis wore white, and there's like a little gumshoe or something like that.
Right,
Babaji. That's the sannyasi in the Gaudiya tradition.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Except, starting from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who went to South India, studied the Ramanujacharya sannyasis, and he said, well, that's good, we should copy them. Even though it's not part of our tradition, Lord Chaitanya, sometimes you see pictures of Lord Chaitanya with a saffron dhoti, but actually he wore it the Babaji style, you know, the white dhoti. Like the Goswamis of Vrindavan, they had that. So you see, he was doing things for the purpose of preaching, giving people Krishna consciousness. And that's what we have to remember, the goal. The method is important, but if the method gets in the way, then we have to think twice about it. You know, if our promise gets in the way of doing something, you know, let's say it's a Kadasi, you take a Mona Vrata. I promise I'm not going to preach. I'm not going to speak today. Some devotees do that. Just going to chant. And then some nice person walks in the temple and want to hear about Krishna. He said, And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is ready to give rights to people on Ekadashi. I'm not saying we should do that. But, you know, look at that. You know, so all the principles. So I was just using this example of Grandfather Bhishma, who was attached to the activity itself rather than the result of the activity and considering that to be moral. He learned this lesson, of course, at the end when it was too late. Okay, any other questions? Yeah, Rana?
Just for the record, it was in 1930... I think it was 1935. John Anderson, the governor of Bengal, came to my house on the invitation of my friend. And then he asked the Muslim neighbors to prepare meat
yeah.
for the British because they figured that what they want. But then the British didn't want meat, actually. They didn't have vegetarian food.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
But just for the record.
Yeah, he didn't directly prepare the meat, but
yeah.
he had... Yeah.
I had a question also, because... I think the points you made are very relevant, very important.
Yeah.
But then there is also a problem, I think. Not from our point of view, because, of course, the goal of serving Krishna and preaching is the most important. But let's say there is a problem on another side, from the outside perspective, because it may be also that people may perceive that devotees are not reliable. Because the impression could be, that if we do everything for Krishna service and the result
that's
is the main
point.
Thing, so we're not so principle centered. That means you never know what Hare Krishna is going to do because you know he's you know anyway he's going to do the practical stuff.
That's a good
and, you
point.
Know, he could lie. He could do anything to serve Krishna. So then we have a problem.
Yeah. Well, let me address that point. Okay. First of all, that would be counterproductive. If we lie, if we don't tell the truth, it's counterproductive. It's only in exceptional circumstances. Like to save someone's life or something like that. We're not advocates like Shukracharya, because you quoted Shukracharya. Shukracharya said you can lie when joking, you can lie when you're talking to a woman, right? You remember that?
No.
The Bhagavatam. Yeah, there's that story in the Bhagavatam.
Yeah, yeah.
It's actually a funny story. When he's talking to Bali Maharaj and saying, don't keep your word.
Right, yeah.
So, no, it's only exceptional circumstances. Like to save someone's life. Not on a normal basis, no. Because it's counterproductive to spreading our movement if we lie. It's counterproductive because it'll ruin our reputation.
Yeah.
For one who has been honored, dishonored is worse than death. And then once you lose your reputation, nobody listens to you anymore. So it's very important for devotees to be known as truthful. In fact, that's one of the Brahminical principles. Is it some of the Bhakshocha? Yeah. It's one of the Brahminical principles, the devotee principles. So we should be truth tellers. But we shouldn't be so determined to stick to things that it will cause havoc later on in life. That's the point. You know, that it'll cause havoc. Not that we lie to people to make... You can't lie to people to make them Krishna conscious because they won't trust you later on. It's as simple as that. So it's counterproductive to doing that. So we should be known as truth tellers, but we should also be known as practical people. Like, it's not a lie that you break your vow or mona vrata to preach to someone if they want to come to the temple and hear about Krishna. Please tell me about Krishna. And you pull out the sign, mona vrata for 2 weeks. And you know, it's a codicil, no food for you. You have to follow a codicil. So, yeah, another question?
This is very important. Very much, I have an experience of this also in my life. And sometimes you say that you just think if we lie, but the purpose is not, as you say, to lie for, we have to lie for good purpose, right? To lie for help.
To help someone, to save someone.
Especially when it's all about doing one's service. And that service is, what do you say, aligned with Krishna's will. So Krishna can tell me also, then you have to fight also for saying the service. Then you have not to lie, and then when you have lied, then you can say, confess that you have lied, but in a very humble way, then it is accepted. Because then you can both have the one that you wanted to have and the one that sees you
as a liar.
As a liar.
Yeah.
So you cannot, since we have to do, because Krishna is so, we have not to be, what you say, it's good to be seen as a liar sometimes. Because Krishna wants that also, he said.
Yeah.
But if it's for a good purpose, then you fight for it.
Yeah, and they should be honest about it.
Yeah,
I mean, even in ordinary, you know, politics or government things, I'm not talking about, you know, bad politics. Then you have spies from one country to go to another country, and they have to lie just to accomplish their purpose. I mean, how do they find Osama? You know, I'm sure there was a lot of lying and cheating and everything like that to find him. So that's normal. Normal behavior in this world. However, yes, you should be honest about it, the purpose behind it, you know, saving someone's life. I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, a lot of times one cannot be completely straightforward for a variety of reasons. I mean, I'm not going to give, this is a funny example, but I'm not going to give that. Let's say Prabhupada said that someone's married and the wife says, am I attractive or something like that. Then you can't say, oh, you're ugly as sin. then it would be extremely dangerous for the welfare of the person. So you have to say yes. Yes, because you're a spirit soul. Spirit souls are attractive. Anyway. So you can justify things like that. It's not that we should lie. No, we should not be known as truthful persons. However, in exceptional circumstances, yes, it's necessary. It's actually necessary. I mean, I remember preaching going into certain countries where they wouldn't allow devotees in. So they asked me, you know, they look at me real closely. You know, I took my neck beads off. But, you know, are you Hare Krishna? Hare Krishna? What's that? Huh? Krishna? I didn't even pronounce it right. Chris, what? So where are you going to stay? Oh, I'm just going to go to the Ramada Inn, you know, the hotel. So, you know, there's a little lie for preaching Krishna. I mean, what can you do? I mean, like devotees who are sneaking books into China or previously into Russia. There's certain exceptional circumstances. I mean, the Christians do that. So it's not that lying or not lying is an absolute principle, but it has to be applied with care as to the result. So if you're known as people who lie, then no one will be attracted to you, because the earth can't bear the weight of a sinful liar, and people just don't trust you. Once you catch someone lying, you don't trust them anymore. That's my experience, isn't it? When someone lies to me at that point, I never trust them for the rest of my life. Does that make sense? So any other questions? Yeah.
Maharaj, I have a comment there. I heard Bhaktivedanta Purna Maharaj make the distinction between facts and truth. Say the truth is what works and fact is like false information.
Yeah.
Like in the case of, you know, someone asking you, are you Hare Krishna? And truth is,
I'll have to digest that one.
No, sorry. I didn't mean like that. Like truth is that you have to get through and preach Krishna consciousness.
Yeah, yeah. The truth is the service to Krishna.
Yeah.
But we have to be careful. The problem is that it's very important, because it's not that, you know, transcendental trickery, you know, do anything, say anything. It's not like that. A religious person should be an extremely truthful person and trustworthy person. Very, very important. However, in exceptional circumstances, I mean, I can think of a lot of exceptional circumstances. Let's say someone's injured in the street and, you know, they could die. You want to give them some hope. You don't want to lie to them. You want to say that, you know, I've seen people recover like this before and get better. You know, there's great hope. In the mind, you're thinking, this person's finished. So you know, this is a circumstance. There's many circumstances that arise where you have to do things like that. And it would be cruel or harmful to do otherwise. And I can think of many circumstances like that. So, I mean, even a teacher sometimes has to say to a student, you know, you've improved a lot, you're doing a good job. When the student, you know, is a challenged individual. Let's say if you're working with autistic, you know, autistic children? You know, children who have some, anyway, there's a problem. You have to encourage them. You can't say, you know, you're just a spastic, you know, you can't get anything together. You're hopeless and you're useless. Huh? You can't do that to people. I mean, there's higher principle. The principle of compassion is a higher principle. So it takes great intelligence to decide, you know, discern what and how to act at every service. You can't just follow things ritualistically. You know, just like be attached to certain externals. Even, you know, our dress. You know, the dress, the dhoti, whatever we wear. You have to understand what's the purpose of the whole thing. Yeah.
I was sitting in the Sankirtan car once and chanting my Gayatri, and then this guy comes up and says, you can't park here. I was parking in a yard.
Yeah.
And I had heard that you you never interrupt your Gayatri except, you know, for your guru. So I was just chanting, and he was knocking on the window, hey, you can't. And I was just refusing to.
Oh my God.
So he became hysterical, and he thought I was crazy. So you know, I could have avoided that by being intelligent, but in those days I was not. I mean, I'm not now. But you know, in those days I was a real fanatic, so I just kept chanting my God, not listening to that guy. He became completely hysterical, smashing on the window.
Yeah, could you imagine? You know, and you're probably moving your lips. Sitting there moving your lips, and you're lucky he didn't call the hospital people to pick you up. Yeah, so you have to understand, like, there's an injunction, you don't stop your Gayatri for anything.
Yeah.
In that case, you should have.
Can one say that after this lecture that one has to be actually Krishna consciousness is
about being aware.
Yeah, being aware.
And all the time in the present, in this moment, and being aware in this moment all the time, not thinking about the future and the past. And whatever is happening, one has to adjust, as you said.
Yes, it's being practical.
Yeah.
Krishna conscious person is practical. And the main point is we just don't want to get attached to the rituals without understanding the ritual, the purpose behind the rituals,
yeah,
behind the activities. You have a question about that?
Going back to Bhishma, one question can be raised that Bhishma could so easily sacrifice the whole kingdom and make such a strong vow for the higher purpose, the satisfaction of the father. He is also one of the Mahajanas who know the tattva of the principles.
Mm-hmm.
So how can he miss the higher purpose that you see? Like his promise, strong vow, irrespective of no matter the world.
Yeah, how can he break that vow?
So, no, how can he be so foolish, if I use the word, not to see the higher purpose?
It was actually, Bhishma is a great devotee, he's under Yogamaya, so it was Krishna's plan to show this particular, to show an example, that's my understanding of the pastime. And when examining different, let's say, duties, one has to understand priorities. What is a higher priority and what is a lower priority? Certainly, following your father's order or desire is very important, or a promise to your father is very important. But what's higher than that? In any sort of activity or vow or promise or obligation, there's always higher and lower obligations. You understand what I'm talking about? You know, so one has to sometimes sacrifice the lower obligations to meet the higher obligations. So that's really understanding things in their proper perspective. And that's what Bhishma failed to do. I mean, it was obviously a higher obligation to protect the Pandavas. I mean, we know that. So your question is, why didn't Bhishma know that? Even though it's, as we say in English, it's a no-brainer. He should have known that. Because the society was also different than that. There's several reasons. One is, he's setting an example, pastime. Another one is, society was different at that time. It was more of a ritualistic society. If you examine Indian history, you'll see that even in modern age, rituals were actually, I mean, thousands of years ago, maybe 2,000, when did Buddha first, about 2,500 or something like years ago?
Around 500.
Yeah, 2,500 years ago. Like just before Buddha, the Brahmanas had become, you know, very extremely ritualistic, you know, just like, anything you want, and Brahmins generally have to keep a fire going in their house all the time, and anything you wanted to do, if you wanted to get married, if you wanted to die, anything you wanted, you had to call a Brahmin, you know, they had a, what we call a monopoly on rituals. And so they were very much into this, and they were basically forgetting the purpose of the Vedic literatures. And so there was a revolt against them. And that revolt was more of a philosophical revolt. At that time, there was, of course, the Buddhas, the Jains, and the Aranyakas. Mm-hmm. There are three types of people who revolted against that ritualistic understanding. The Buddhas, who rejected the Vedas, and the Jains, too. And then the Aranyakas are those who accepted the Vedas, but they went to the forest, that's what Aranyaka means, and just didn't want to get into all the rituals, didn't want to understand the purpose behind the Vedas. And of course, then you have the Upanishads, which deal with the purpose behind all the Vedic rituals. The Upanishads, Vedanta, and the other literatures, the Brahmanas, yeah, the Brahmana literatures. The Brahmana literatures also were discussing about rituals to a large extent. So you find this sort of thing happening throughout history, where religion gets very, let us say, solidified and very much into rituals, and they forget the purpose, and then they go through a period of reform, and that happened in Catholicism too, in the Protestant Reformation. And then that same religion, which was the reformer, becomes, you know, too much ritualized. You see that happening to a certain extent in ISKCON too. ISKCON was very just like, well, maybe a little too loose in the beginning. And then we get into all these defense, then deity worship becomes so much a specialized process that nobody can do it anymore, except for someone who's been trained for 500 years. Right? Isn't it? I mean, things get... And I'm seeing on the management level of ISKCON, too. Of course, this also involves the what we call the post-charismatic phase of ISKCON. Like the charismatic phase is when Prabhupada was there, and then after Prabhupada left, some people tried to imitate Prabhupada's charisma. We had some interesting times then. And now we're in the post-charismatic phase, where things tend to get more like bureaucraticized, if I can coin a word. Things tend to get more bureaucratic. So, like if you go on the GBC now, everybody thinks if you go to GBC meeting, we're all chanting Hare Krishna and dancing in ecstasy, right? But it's just like this committee and that committee and that strategic planning and the other strategic planning. It gets a little bit too much, for me at least. Whereas some people love bureaucracy. So generally in a religious society, the bureaucrats take over after a certain point, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then you get so much into bureaucracy that, you know, the people feel constrained, and then you'll have a revolution or a new movement after some time. It's interesting, isn't it? When you study the history of religion, what happens? You lose that spirit. And Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said something like, there's never been an institution in history that has not destroyed the spirit, and I'm paraphrasing, of religion, of a particular religion, which is really interesting. So hopefully we can avoid that in ISKCON. I'm not being negative about ISKCON. I'm just saying that we're trying our best, because Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur did start an institution, the Gaudiya Math, and he wanted the GBC and everything like that. So, but it's a very delicate balance between the rules and regulations, you know, the structure and the internal development of bhakti. It's a very delicate balance. You know, you can actually destroy the internal development if you get too much into bureaucracy. And if you get too much into the internal development without the bureaucracy, you can destroy the order. And you can simply have a bunch of individual maths who are doing their own things, and the people who are not even realizing in spiritual life and using, and they're using elevated subject matters to carry out material purposes. You know, so it's really interesting to see the dichotomy of things happening like that. If you study the history of religions, and you know, ISKCON fits into the sociological parameters that have been mentioned in the history and religious sociology. Mm. You know, it's a typical case. But what we're presenting is something that's a postgraduate study of religion. So we can't forget that we're here to present something that's helps us, you know, realize the ultimate truth, go back to Godhead, and has the highest understanding of the absolute truth. Okay, I think we should end now because tons of people on the TV are getting hungry too. All right, all glories. This is all glory. Yeah.